We're learning text, context, and tradition. Okay, the thesis before us is one that I probably don't have to convince you to too great an extent. It's that the Torah is not given in a vacuum. While to the Orthodox Jew, and this is an Orthodox institution, Orthodox means true doctrine. We believe our doctrine is everlasting. Right? But we take it as a given at this institution that the scholarship that we can apply to our study of Tanakh, based on what the Israelites were exposed to in their daily lives, may have some influence on how certain psukim appear to them and how they're observed. This is not to say, and here's where Orthodox parts company with Reform and more recently Conservative. Conservative is supposed to be with Orthodox on this. I've studied their graduate school 35 years ago. The origins of the Conservative movement in the United States. And while it's certainly developing over time, but it's supposed to be very close to Orthodox in its practice of the mitzvahs of Torah. They will be open to other, sometimes more practice than Orthodox with respect to women or the like. But they have moved very far away in this practice. I'm not going to go into politics on this. But here's the point. The Orthodox Jew says it may very well be that the original reason why we're not supposed to eat milk and meat together, right? The original reason why it was revealed to us has nothing to do with us today. Implying, this is the Rambam, the Mor Nebuchim, implying that if the Torah were given today, this would not be a mitzvah for us, right? Implying that. Okay, I must admit full disclosure, there are many Rishonim who don't like this approach to studying the Torah. Right, who read the Rambam and says this is a slippery slope. People will one day say, then we can wear shatnez today. No one's wearing wool and linen to show dominance over plant and animal kingdoms. Right? No one is cooking milk and meat to show dominance over the crops and over life and death. No one's drinking blood as part of seances today to communicate with the dead. So what do I have to do? Get rid of all the blood in my steak. I like a rare steak. Right? So that's where Orthodox parts with the other branches. Anyone wants to make a comment on this, please. So what I'd like to do with some of these examples, we'll just do this for today and move on in the next class, okay? Is I want to give a few cases where you might have read a mitzvah differently had you. Because you didn't know this element of an ancient code, of what the Israelites were exposed to, right? I use an example that's actually not in this in these pages. I'm going to start with this, and I'm going to make just a simple triangle of Egyptian law, which the Jews, goodness, we spent hundreds of years in Egypt. We probably were aware of some of their laws. Babylonian law, the Code of Hammurabi. And Sumerian law. Sumer was a powerful nation that was not on top of the world, but had a great influence in the ancient world for hundreds of years. And all three of these have left significant law codes for us to analyze today. Right? We have deciphered them. We know exactly what they refer to, and it's before us. Now, besides these three main ones, there are scores of others where we don't have the full codes, but we have a piece here, a piece there. We find a rock that refers to what you should do in certain cases of a rebellious child. Right? And what we can do in the Torah is to compare how the Torah treats this particular issue with the way these ancient codes do. And it's there, right? It's there to be found. It's been authenticated. These are not hoaxes. We know Sumerian law, for instance. There is a law on there, but there's no such law in the Torah, but there's a story in the Torah that relates directly to this law that says if a couple is married for, doesn't say how many years, but a long time where it seems they do not have hope of bearing a child together. Right? Halacha seems to say something about 10 years. There's a lot of confusion about that. It's a Gemara in Yevamos because it says in last week's parasha that Avraham and Sarah were 10 years living in Canaan before Sarah came up with the advice of doing something about it. Right? You'll know what I'm talking about. Correct? So they're living together for a good long time, and they have given up hope of having children in the conventional way. The wife, the mistress of the family, the head of the family, shall choose a woman, a bondswoman, or anyone else that she feels will be loyal to her and is subservient to her. A bondswoman is someone who's her slave. Shall be given to her husband to bear a child for her, and that woman, the mistress of the family, shall take the child and reward the woman handsomely. The woman may remain in the household and nurse, of course, and be a nanny to the child. But the child shall grow and become the child of the... Oh, it sounds like Bas Parah with Moshe, right? But it sounds even more so like...
Sarah and Hagar.
Sarah and Hagar. It doesn't... Didn't ring a bell to any of your heads? Sarah and Hagar, right? So Sarah is acting in concert with ancient convention. It's not out of the blue that Sarah thinks, this is on a very well-traveled and well-known law code, right? That this is what is done in the ancient world. Okay? So it's interesting. Let's say I'll give you three mefarshim. Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Sforno, of what Sarah meant when she said, take this woman, ulai ibonem mimeno. Ulai ibonem mimeno. Right? Translate a few words. Maybe I will build up something through her. Right? Ibn Ezra says, no, it means perhaps I will get a son through her. You get it? Alright, there's no coincidence. The word for building is the same as the word for son for a reason. Right? Rashi captures that and says, because Sarah felt, I am not built up because I have no children, I am destroyed. Eni banui ela harus. Right? You get it? Okay, so ulai ibanem mimena, according to Ibn Ezra, means I will get a son through this action. Ibn Ezra seems to be mechaven to the ancient parallel in Samaria. You agree? Right? I will take the son. The son will be mine. Got it? Rashi doesn't like that. Rashi perhaps considers that this is just cruel. How can you have a woman bear a child and another woman takes it? Right? So Rashi says, ulai ibonem mimena means perhaps by doing this unselfish act for the sake of my husband, I will be zochet to have a son of my own. Ulai ibonem mimena. Sforno says something, listen to Sforno, he says, when I contemplate, this is an amazing chiddush for the 15th century, when I contemplate that there's another woman sleeping with my husband, right, the jealousies that will rage in my mind will clear up in my body whatever is stopping me from becoming pregnant, and I'll get my own child. Right? It's more like Rashi or Ibn Ezra.
Rashi.
Of course, it's more like Rashi.
I think
right?
Extreme.
But there's a raging debate today whether there are psychological barriers to conception. Right? Most fertility experts say there are none, but you know what? If the clinical definition of infertility is to go 1 year trying to have a child and not being able to, go 1 year, you are considered an infertile couple. Right? I would have thought 10, 15 years. No, 1 year. Right? So if you go to a fertility expert, and hopefully everybody has 100% chance of being a parent, and they say, I'm sorry, based on the evidence before you, for both you and you, you have a 22% chance of being a parent together. And that is affected 3 or 4% by your mindset? At 22%, I'll take anything. Right? So 3% is usually considered insignificant in these percentages. Anyway, Sforno says something amazing here. He says that, but it's in the realm of Rashi. You get it? I don't want to get off too far in this portion. So here, but listen to what continues. And by the way, there's an excellent book that you should at least be aware of. It's called Understanding Genesis. Understanding Genesis by Jonathan Sarna. Right? Understanding Genesis. And this book goes through, compares ancient codes like this and then puts it aside, the Psukim and the Torah. So the law continues. What happens if there's a falling out between the two women? Wow! That's our story! What happens if the women don't get along? It's very nice, hunky-dory, if this woman who bore the child stays on as a nanny, is happy raising the kid. All right, the decision of where he's going to go to school and whether he's going to marry is still in the hands of the mistress of the household, but I'm there with him all the time. I'm okay with that. What happens if the two women don't get along? Right? What shall be done? So this law code says, the bondswoman shall be freed. She shall be given her freedom, right? She shall be dismissed to go her merry way. What's missing here? What happens to the child? It says, of course, this woman arranged for her to, the woman keeps the child. Just goodbye. Very cruel. You send this woman away without the child, right? Sarah, at the end, has a falling out with her. At first, she allows her back into the household. I'm okay with her. I can deal with her insolence and the way she behaves towards me. But as soon as the child she bore, that's in chapter 16, by the way, where Rabban, guys, only half of you are paying attention. Please tune in. Make my experiment here. We're not going to get a final. Something that works for you and me. Right? That's the whole point, is that you're getting something out of the classroom. Okay? That means you got to tune in. That means you got to shut off whatever else you're doing. Right? So, chapter 16, Ramban, especially, but some of Radak has a commentary only, but we only have to Horatius. It's very critical of Sarah's behavior with Hagar. Right? Ramban says that because Sarah was cruel to Hagar in chapter 16, this week's past week's parsha, that's why Hagar gave birth to a child who would afflict us throughout the Middle Ages. He's referring clearly, whether he's right or wrong genealogically, he's probably wrong. But to call the Muslims Yishmael is probably genealogically wrong. All right? But it doesn't matter. The Jews writing in the Middle Ages felt that Yishmael was a Muslim. So to say that Sarah's mistreatment of Hagar is the reason why the Muslims mistreat us, and it's only when compared to Christianity that it was a little better, but it was not great. There were forced conversions all over the Middle Ages in the Muslim world, right, and pogroms. Just not as bad as the Christians. Plus, the poskim were telling the Jews, better to convert to Islam than to die, because what you have to do to convert to Islam is not avodah zarah. Right? But at the same time, they were telling them, you have to die rather than do what the Christians want you to do. Okay? So I'm just saying. So for someone to write in the 13th century that the Muslims afflict us all these years, for the last 500, 600 years, because of what Sarah did to Hagar in chapter 16 of Bereishis, right? It's significant. That's the Ramban's derech. The Torah is a template for Jewish history. Right? The Medrash already said that. But the Medrash says the Torah is a template, especially Sefer Bereishis, for the history of Tanakh. Ramban went one step further. Can you feel what I just said? How does Ramban go further? Something that happens in Sefer Bereishis is the cause of something that Haman does in Megillas Esther. That's okay. That's in Tanakh itself. How did the Ramban go beyond that? He took the events of Sefer Bereishis to his own day. Right? Can you think of something in Bereishis that Ramban uses to explain why the Christians subjugate us? What happened in Sefer Bereishis that makes the Christians overlord us? God said, "The younger one will overcome the older one." Yes.
That Yaakov stole the bracha from Esav, or not that?
So Yaakov didn't steal a bracha from Esav, these Ramban says. Yaakov took a bracha that was his. Okay, I'm just saying Ramban. Okay? Esav sold it to him. Esav should have told that to his father when he called him over to give him a bracha. Yaakov took back what was his. So why are Christians subjugating us? Come on, you're on the right track.
Oh, because...
You're talking about Parshas Toldos.
Oh, because he was going to die. So it was like a forced deal or something.
Yeah, Esav was not going to die there. He said, "Hinei anochi holeich lamus," means I don't care about my bracha, my firstborn right, because I face death every day in the field. I don't care about tomorrow or my birthright or what I'm giving my children. I live for today. He wasn't dying that day. Everyone misunderstands that whole story. Right? Not saying, "Oh, my brother's about to die here. A little soup, see, you'll live. Give me your whole life savings." It's ridiculous. Christians love to read the story that way. About the Jews, so, you know, abusing everybody. It's not what that story is. Right? Yaakov gave him something of great value. Yaakov nosan le'esav. It doesn't say by yitain Yaakov le'esav a bowl of soup, your birthright. It's ridiculous. Right? Yaakov had given him something. It doesn't say what it was. The reader doesn't care what it was. It was a baseball card collection. He gave him something of great value that Esav wanted all those years. And Yaakov said, "Okay, you give me this, I'm getting your brother." And he said, "I don't care about my birthright. I'm not even going to outlive Daddy. So what difference does that make to me? I live for today." Right? I'm going to die tomorrow in the field. What do I care about? That's what it means. But so what did Yaakov do in Sefer Bereishis that makes Esav overlord him for the rest of history? Or at least until a time comes when I meet you at Seir. That's why Ovadia says, "V'alu Moshim Bahar Tzion lishpot et haresav," and only then by Salashen Halucha. Because in Parshas Vayishlach, you know what Yaakov did? He gave the bracha back. He was afraid Esav was going to kill him. So look how he talks to him in Parshas Vayishlach. He gave the bracha back. He prepares a big gift for his brother. That gift is called a mincha. And when he finally meets him, he says, "Hey, Yaakov, what is all this gift? What is all these gifts?" He says, "Kach no es birchosi asher uvaslach. I give you the bracha back. Hasn't done me any good. Everything Daddy told me that you thought he was supposed to give to you hasn't done me any good. I don't have Tal Shemayim. I don't have Shemane Oretz. I don't have Rodev on the Sirosh." And Daddy said, "Your brother will bow down to you." Who's bowing down to whom right here? Ramban is very critical of Yaakov's behavior in Parshas Vayishlach. His servile behavior set the stage for the rest of history, for your descendants and his descendants. Wow. Look how Ramban reads Sefer Bereishis. All right? What he does with the Muslims in Parshas Lech Lecha, he does with the Christians in Parshas Vayishlach. All right? I'm telling you all this because in chapter 21, when Sarah frees, I don't mean the word she banishes her. I say Goresha Sa'ama means free her. You're making a mistake. Gerushin is the word in the Gemara for divorce. When a man divorces his wife, he doesn't banish her. He frees her from a bad marriage. When she says Goresha Sa'ama Azo, she's behaving just the way of the ancient convention. Free her. And you know what? I don't want her kid. By that time, Sarah has her own. That's why she's sending them out. Free her with her kid and let them go. She is acting in a far more moral way than the ancient law allows. And my contention is that she was aware of this law. This was well-known, well-traveled ancient law. Right? And the Torah is telling us a similar story whose understanding, I believe, I hope everyone now in this room also accepts, is enhanced by our knowledge of this material. It can have nothing to do with the story, but it's there. All right? Okay? And there are hundreds of such examples. Okay? So that we get to see that Sarah is saying, I could live with Hagar's insolence to me. She was brought back into the household. This event, and this is now in this week's parsha, chapter 21, where she kicks them out again. That could be many years later, right? According to Chazal, it's something like 25 years later. Right? So, but when he's a bad influence on my son, that I don't put up with. All right? It's just an interesting drasha. What does it say in this week's parsha that made Sarah so upset with Ishmael? It says he was mitzachik. Right? What's wrong with mitzachik? That's what your son's name is. His name is Yitzchak. Right? And this is the stuff of now of drash. This is agodah. This is what the rabbi uses to make a sermon. Right? Who is Esav's father-in-law? He married the daughter of Ishmael. Right? Esav is just like Ishmael. And Ishmael is just like Esav. Mitzachek is for the moment. Mitzachek means I want now. I live for today. Yitzchok is I'm going to behave now so that I have a good later. That's what religion is, after all. That's what the Torah is. I put off the momentary pleasure. Right? I want to be with my wife, but she's a neither, so okay. I'm going to throw myself. I want to eat this food, but it's not kosher. I'm not going to eat it. I want to eat this food, but I'm flacious. I'm not going to eat that. Constantly drawing back. That's not Yitzchak, that's not Yishmael, and that's not Esav. So all this comes full circle about why Sarah is justified. Ramban says, I'm so critical of Sarah in Parshas Lech Lecha for kicking Hagar out, but in Parshas Vayera he says, Sarah is absolutely right this time to kick her out. Together with Ishmael, get out of here. Alright? Okay, so does this now, I'll get your question in a second. If you would see Hittite law, and this is especially important, we have a whole litany of Hittite law about how to sell and buy land. If you are a resident, if you are a foreigner, if you are a resident foreigner, right? What parsha might this shed some light on?
Something in Vayikra, probably.
In Parshas Chayisara, Avraham's wife dies. Right, Ephron Ha? Chiti, he's a Hittite. In Parshas Chayisara, Abraham, I don't know how this happened, but, I mean, I have a burial plot. I know where my wife and I are supposed to be buried, and I don't expect to kick off for some time now. How did Sarah die? Abraham didn't know where to bury her. I don't know. I can't answer that question. But so he scrambles for a place to bury her, and the way he has to maneuver what's happening in Parshas Chayisara, I'm not going to do it all now, but I'm just saying, is that knowing Hittite law, and what has to happen in order to purchase a plot of land is, and how much land costs at that time. We even have that. Avram paid through the nose for this, but 400 shekel kesef. Right? 500 years later, 10 shekels is a yearly salary in Sefer Shoftim for a person. Right? He is paying a huge amount. And in the end, after they said, oh, take it please, have it for free. Right? And then he insists on paying, and they wow. Right, so now, here's my question I pose to you. The Vilna Gaon was not aware of Hittite law in selling land. Does this mean that the Vilna Gaon was lacking something in his understanding of some stories in Sefer Bereishis? I don't want to say that. I would say he's lacking in a particular dimension of understanding this law. Right? I don't know if the Vilna Gaon would agree with my whole thesis I'm giving you before you today, but I have a reason to suspect that he would allow it. Not from anything he wrote, but something one of his Talmidim Mufakim wrote. The Talmid was Rav Baruch of Shklov. Rav Baruch of Shklov. His Talmid, real Talmid was Rav Chaim Voloshin, but Rav Baruch of Shklov wrote that my Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, said that if you are lacking in any post-Torah, outside Torah, right, knowledge that may shed light on what's written in the Torah, you are lacking in the Torah knowledge. In other words, sort of like Ramban. Remember Ramban, in his last comment to the Torah, Mamish, the last thing he writes in his Perush al Torah, he said, I just made Aliyah, I moved to Yerushalayim, I found a coin. I saw writing on it, and I saw Jewish symbols on it. When he describes it, it's an ancient shekel. It's a lulav and an esrog on it. So I know what Jew made this. Romans weren't minting coins and ruled them in the Nesrom. Right? And there were letters all over it that I couldn't read. I didn't know what this was. And he writes that it seems to me that this is Ksav Ivri. When the Gemara referred to Ksav Ivri, this is what it is. Remember we talked about that earlier this semester? Remember page 24 with all the different alphabets, alphabet letters? All right. Seems to me this is Ksav Ivri. And he made up his mind about a certain machlokas in the Yerushalmi based on finding this coin. It would appear to me that Ramban would endorse what we're doing now. Even though he was the one who mentioned the slippery slope about the Rama, but the Ramban would and by the way, hold on. All the objections against the Rambam of explaining milk and meat, the Rambam says in all of these places, remember the book was called Moret Nivuchim. It was a guide to the perplexed. It was a guide for people who are confused. Right? The Rambam writes many times in the Moreh, but especially in the Mishneh Torah. We're not doing the mitzvahs because they help us, or because it's healthy, or because it's because of any historical. We've been doing the mitzvahs because Hashem said so. Right? In the end, he says there could be nothing more to some mitzvahs than just to inculcate discipline and obedience. Right? While it may not be a good idea when you raise your young children to tell them, because I said so, when they ask you why, don't usually say that. It's not a good idea. Sometimes you have to, on the spot. Tell them why you shouldn't run out in the street in traffic. Right? But usually it's a better idea to say, because it's dangerous. So what does dangerous mean? Okay, so I'm just saying, it's dangerous to do what human beings were doing in Parshas Noach. Rashi, I think Rashi hits it right on. He says, "Vatishochis kol basar lifnei Hashem." Vatishochis kol basar. Why doesn't it say "Vatishochis kol adam lifnei Hashem"? Right? We say in benching. Who knows saying lechem? L'chol basar kila olam chasdo. What's the pshat? He prepares food for meaning.
Not just Jews,
but that Adam would also be all humans. What is who knows saying lechem l'chol basar? Come on, never read Baruch Nafshi. All living things. Baruch Nafshi talks about the food that God gives for us and for the birds and for the fish and for the animals and. So everything that every animal needs is out there. All right, we ruin it for some of them by taking them out of their habitat or by removing certain lands where they flourish. Right, but other than that, the world is perfectly situated for food and for shelter for everything everyone needs. So, what does Vatishochis kol basar lifnei Hashem mean? Anyone want to just venture at it from what we're saying here?
Everything. All living.
What does it mean that a zebra does hashchosa? What is it? Vatishochis kol basar. God punishes zebras for doing wrong things? The famous Rashi, it's Medrash, it's a gracious rabbi, says that animals and humans were rampantly sexually interconnected. Right? And then Rashi writes the next pasuk. When that behavior happens, he uses a Greek word, andromelasia bala olam. Modern translators explain andromelasia as pandemic. Right? The flood story was actually chassidus on God's part. This world is about to be destroyed by a very painful pandemic because of what humans are doing. Right? Go Google right now what started the AIDS virus, right? In 1985. They've identified it. They've even identified the place, the animal, and what happened afterwards. They've known. Right? They made movies about this with the pig and the bat right? Okay. They killed 4 billion people before someone figured out what happened. All right? The flood was v'tishachez kol basod. So God tells us certain things. This is now more of a Kabbalistic way of reading the Torah. And we don't know what it is. Because of I read something in coincidentally in a sacred text of a Sumerian priest that talks about wearing wool and linen, look at that, the Torah prohibits wool and linen. Maybe there's a connection there. Maybe yes, maybe no. Right? What's more important than all of this is that you're wearing tzitzis right now. Because it's all about the continuity of us sitting here and learning. That's why you're a YU. Chances are most of you have had 12 years of Jewish education. What are we getting out of that? Can you be getting an Aliyah to Shabbos and do a Haftorah to Shabbos? Do you feel comfortable doing that? I'm not saying that's the end all of all your Jewish education, but it's got to be something where, if you're a place like this, you combine your practice with a profound, phenomenal knowledge of what's the background of it all. Where's it all going? Okay, very quickly. I'm going to just mamish go over these very quickly. Vicarious punishment. Why do I have to be told that I'm not going to punish you for something you did? I'm not going to punish a father for the sins of his son or a son for the sins of his father. Because in the Holy Code of Hammurabi, chapter 48, that's exactly what they do. If you kill your neighbor's son, your son gets killed. So the Torah feels, you know what? A law code usually shouldn't have to write that a child will suffer for the sins of the parent. Wait a second. Once I feel so holy about being better than the Code of Hammurabi by modern standards, isn't there a pasuk that says, Poked avon avos al banim? I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. Isn't that a profound contradiction? Right? So there's a Gemara in the beginning of Brachas that tries to resolve this contradiction. You may know it. It's in the Targum Onkelos, actually. That says, I visit the iniquity of the parents on wicked children. All right. That's an answer. You get it? If the child does not follow the way of the parents, of course I'm going to do that. That's not fair. You get it? You get how Targum Onkelos tries to resolve this theological problem, right? I'm not sure that that's the correct answer. The pshat answer. I think the difference is very simple. The pasuk that says, don't kill children for the sins of the parents, doesn't say it that way. It says, a child shall not be put to death for the sins of his parents. Lo yumasu, not lo yamusu. If a child dies for the sins of the parent, that contradicts the pasuk in Poked Avon Avos. What is your ear hear when it says, a child shall not be put to death for his parents' sins? Who is that talking to? The courts, based in of here in the world, up in Shemayim. I don't know how God works. Maybe a 2-year-old child died now because of something 500 years ago that happened in his family. I don't know how God works. It's not my business. But I do know some 2-year-old children have died. And there's no good reason theologically why that should happen to a 2-year-old. Right? Okay? How God works, I don't know. I'm not going to ask. So it gives me problems. It gives me doubts. Right? All right? But okay. So when the Code of Hammurabi writes, we will in the courts kill A for the sin of B, I have a reasonable sense of why the Torah has to tell me this. Okay? The Torah prohibits men to wear women's clothes and women to wear men's clothes. Look at the top of page 42. Now, insofar as I've asked you to prepare this pamphlet for today, don't put too many of you even have it on your desk. Right? I don't even know where to go with this. Right? There is a qualitative difference between the way the Torah writes this. Okay? Qualitative difference is, it says, a man shall not wear a woman's dress, which is specific. A woman shall not wear the kalim of a man, which is general. Why does the Torah list it that way? Why don't I just mention a garment of a man that a woman shouldn't wear, like you mentioned a garment of a woman that a man shouldn't wear? You get the point? And if you live in Scotland and you wear a skirt, are you violating this law? You're not. But the question is, why is the woman's garment general? Don't wear the kalim of a man. What does kalim of a man even mean? What does it sound like?
What? Tools, like weapons.
Weapons, correct. That's what Maran Nazir in Hefchav Kemal says. A woman shall not wear armor. It's a very, very well-traveled ancient epic called the Epic of Krek. It's one of the most popular ancient stories. It's as popular as Harry Potter is today, as everyone knew this story. And it's all about a woman who has this almost like a sexual desire to wear men's armor. Right? So I just put it out there that it's possible that the reason why the Torah lists this way, there's no specific garment a woman is not supposed to wear. Pants might be a tznius issue. But it's certainly, if it's a woman's pants, it's not an issue, right? So, especially in the world today where you don't know what's what. Okay. All right, so let me just... Re'u ki ra'o neged p'neichem. Paro tells Moshe as they're about to go out to... As he claims, I want to go out to Egypt. Paro says, go out already. All right. But be careful. It's ra'o neged p'neichem. Now, what does ra'o there mean? Something bad, right? What bad thing will happen to you in the desert if you take all those people out? It's obvious. The first 2 days you're out there, what's going to happen? You're all going to die of thirst. And even if you take enough water, how much water are you going to take? Right? Die of thirst and heat exhaustion. Right? So Rashi says there was a sun god that the Egyptians worshipped named
Ra.
Rashi was aware of this. It was such a popular name and people were aware. So, Re'u ki Ra, oh, it's a whole new understanding now. So, you know, when God wanted to destroy Bnei Yisrael at the Egel, and Moshe, what was Moshe's argument? Anyone can paraphrase it in Hebrew? You killed them all here. Lama yomru mitzrayim kipa ra'al tziyam. Don't you think the Egyptians are all going to say, great argument! You can get the best of God here. You know what the Egyptians will say if you kill all of them now and make me a great nation like you're threatening? They'll say, what killed them was not that they made an eagle and angered their God. What killed them was
our God.
Ra. Okay. What's the next plague after they said this? What do you think? Choshech. Right? You have a sun god? Okay, I'll show you. Actually, the eighth plague had already been predicted, and wouldn't you know it, in the eighth plague it says that the Arbe was so numerous, Vatechas es ein ha'aretz, Vatechshach ha'aretz. First, the lowly locust blotted out your son, and then you'll see what we're going to do to your son. Now, you ever hear of the Hertz Chumash? H-E-R-T-Z? Hertz Chumash. He was the chief rabbi of England in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He translated the Torah into English. He wrote a commentary at the bottom, and it was used by all the Orthodox shuls for a long time. It's been supplanted now by art scrolls, but no shul uses it. I haven't seen any Orthodox shul. We used to have in my shul 200 of them. We couldn't use them anymore. No one wanted them. They're big, bulky. It's the whole Torah in one volume. All right, so... So in Hertz Chumash on Machas Choshech, he says, we're aware of a total eclipse of the sun that passed through Egypt. He gives the particular year of it, and he is off in the year. He is off in where the total eclipse was. He wrote this in the 50s. And the total eclipse of the sun only passes through an area for a few minutes, not for 3 days, right? So he writes, they were blinded for 3 days because they looked at it and they were amazed by it. And they, right? That's, I know he's doing exactly what I've been doing here all morning today with you. Right? And he even in the commentary, he says, We are all aware that 1924, on January 17th, on 96th Street, it's two blocks from where I live, and this is attested by many, on a very snow-swept day, a total eclipse of the sun made 96th Street North black, and 96th Street South was daytime. That's a tip. The New York Times wrote that. Right? That there's an actual line in New York City where the total eclipse went this way, midnight black. That way, it's light. Must be an amazing sight from high up. But it's 1924. Alright? Get it with it. Now, right up the block, there's a 40-story building. But that time, the buildings were 2-3 stories, 4 stories, 6 stories. Maybe. All right. So he uses that and saying, because it says, "Ulechol b'nei Yisrael ha'yor b'moshfo sam." You get it? The Jews had lights just right over, and they didn't. You get it? So what he's trying to do is, and he deserves schar for trying to do it, because he's writing for a perplexed audience. You get it? So he's trying to explain, how could there be light here for them, and there's no light for them? Okay? Alright, there's some schar for doing this. Okay, I'm just going to close with one thing. I'm going to close with the Pim. I'll close with this. In Shmuel Aleph, Perek Gimel, it says the Jews had no weapons of war to fight the Plishtim. Right? And what they did was they took farming implements, rakes and hoes and shovels, and they had them sharpened in order to take to battle. And it says when they sharpened them, Ha-ptsirapim. Very difficult two words to translate. Ptsira can mean to sharpen them. What does this word mean? It's a hapax legomena. Who here remembers what that means?
Only appears once.
A word that only appears once, right? So it never appears again in the whole Tanakh. So how can I figure out what it means? So Rashi in his Perush says it's the plural of this word, peh. That a farming implement, let's say a sickle, has a bunch of mouths in the hand. And they would sharpen them, the serrated edges, in order to use them and swing them and walk in a battle. Okay? Alright. Rashi's Talmud Chavar of Yosef Kara writes in his Perush, not to be confused with the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Kara says, I don't know what Pim means, but I'm pretty sure that the plural of Peh is Piyot. So I'm not sure if this is correct. I just don't know what it means. Right? If you look on page 45 of your Choveret, there is a picture of a rock or a coin looks very much like our Yud. Men looks like running water, and Pei looks like almost supposed to look like a mouth. So, the coin appears here, and it's a weight. It's a weight. According to the archaeology, Haptzira means the charge, not the charge. What Haptzir means, to charge someone, was a pim in order to sharpen their implements. It tells you how much they paid. Why does it bother telling you that? So I have a biblical book of a coin, a book of biblical coins, and it has hundreds and hundreds of biblical and ancient coins, and it describes a pim. It says there are only 7 known to us today. There are thousands of shkolim known to us. Shekel was the weight. Shkol means to weigh, right? So I actually held one. I know someone who owns a pim. It says the word pim on it in Savivri. It has been carbon dated to 3,500 years ago. You have to hold it with a glove, right, so that the acid in your fingertips doesn't get on this thing. And you can see it says Pim and Ksav Ivri on it. And I weighed it on a diamond scale, as compared to an ancient shekel. Shekels all look about the same size. Again, there could be erosion on these things. And what I found was, that it was this ratio to a shekel.
Okay.
It's about 2/3 of a shekel. And that's what all these books say. Pim is 2/3 of a shekel. Now, very quickly, I know we have just a few minutes. When a man has two sons, it says in the Torah, and you have $3 million to give to them, you have to give $2 million to your Bechor and $1 million to the other son. Right? What does the Torah call that $2 million? Pi Shnayim. Meaning double. You have to give double to your firstborn. But the Torah in this particular story only refers to two sons. If there were four sons, then the Bechor also gets double. He gets twice as much as everyone else, and they divide it up depending on how much it is. Okay? So it's 5 million and four sons. The old one gets 2 million, the other three get 1 million. Get it? So there's two other places where this word appears. One is where Elisha, just before Eliyahu goes up to the heavens, Eliyahu says, "What do you want from me, Elisha, before I die?" And he says, "I want to be pi shnayim of whatever you are." And Eliyahu says, That's a tall order. You get to see me when I go up to heaven, you'll get it. That's real chutzpah to ask your Rebbe, "I want to be twice as great as you." Right? I'm not sure what it means here. Right? There's only one other place in the whole Tanakh where Pi Shnayim appears. This is Eliyahu Elisha. This is Nachala, Parshas Kisetse. And this is a horrific prophecy in Sefer Zechariah that I hope has happened already. And I think it's a prophecy of the Holocaust. It gives me the right to say such a thing. When you hear it, you'll see why. He says that there will be a huge upheaval of Jews where 2/3 of them shall perish. And the remaining third shall go on to rebuild themselves. And he says, Pi Shnayim of the Jews in that place, which I would like to say means Europe in the 30s, shall perish. Christians love to use this to prove the Jewish subjugation and their suffering throughout history. Pi Shnayim of the Jews shall perish in that place. There were 9 million Jews at the beginning of World War II. 3 million survived. And he says, Pi Shnayim shall perish. And he writes afterwards, the remaining shlish shall return. Got it? I would like to say, I hope, this is a specific reference to the Holocaust. Got it? We'll learn Zechariah some other time. So Pi Shnayim in Zechariah undoubtedly means 2/3. Right? When it comes to having only two sons with $3 million, while it's true that the older son always gets double, but in this particular case in the Torah, it's only talking about two sons. So when you have four sons, one is getting 2/5, and the other three are getting 1/5 each. Got it? But when there are only two sons, while it's true that this can mean double, right? In this case, it can also mean 2/3 of the full estate, right? Got it? I think Elisha was not asking Eliyahu to be twice as great as you. He was asking to be 2/3 as great as you. And even that was asking for a lot. It's not the chutzpah it's made out to be. Got it?
What? Weird fraction asks.
How do you see? What is this coin? What is this coin called? It's called a pim. Now tell me why.
It's 2/3 of a shekel.
It's short for 2/3 of a shekel. You can't write on this small coin Pi Shnayim. Get it? Right? By the fact that the Torah uses that terminology in the law of inheritance, it shows how often does a word have to be in the Bible before it becomes a phrase? It's not a phrase to you because it hasn't been used for 2,500 years. But it was a phrase for their ear. Okay? So he says, "I want to be Pi Shnayim." How would you say 3/4? Pi Arba. How would you say 4/5? Pi Chamesh. Yes? All right? Okay, so based on this little stone, it may be that's a proof that those phrases Pishnayim was shortened for this because we have evidence that this stone is Pishnayim of the general weight, which is a shekel. Okay? See it all? Okay? Is it before we found this pin? Can we say that we didn't know what this pasuk is? I said this before about the Vilna Gaon. What can I say? Maybe Rashi is right. But this recent find, and by the way, the Mosad HaRav Kook, the Das Mik, you know this pink book, this is one, it's not Shmuel, but it's a Sheyav. Right? The Mosad HaRav Kook on this pasuk, the Shmuel Aleph, Perkei Gimel, actually has a picture of a pin. So they used this kind of interpretation. Got it? Okay. They were aware of the pin, and they use it there to say that's what it means. Okay. And it was found, this particular one was found in Lachish, in Israel, and there are only six or seven others known to man. Okay? Alright, guys. That's our thesis for this. We're going to move from here to Midrashei Agadah and Midrashei Halakha.